It's your city. It's our job. District Council 37 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees presents It's Your City. It's Our Job, a program highlighting the work of the 125,000 men and women of DC 37, members of 56 local unions. You'll find DC 37 members everywhere. We're the largest municipal employees union in the city. We're everything from accountants to zookeepers. We are blue-collar, white-collar, technical, and professional. We are District Council 37, working with and for the people of New York City.
Welcome to the radio program of District Council 37. I'm Ken Nash. This is part two of our celebration of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, a union whose fighting spirit has inspired workers since their founding in 1905. Part one was broadcast last week and can be heard over our website, www.dc37.net. Charlie King and Karen Brando are musical storytellers whose repertoire covers a century and a half and four continents. In this concert held at the Catholic Workers' House in New York City recently, they continue their new format of songs with storytelling, producing a stirring and insightful history of the IWW in words and song. And now, Dump the Bosses Off Your Back, 100 Years of the Industrial Workers of the World, with Charlie King and Karen Brando.
Utah Phillips, slow rolling freight from the South Ogden Yard, easing along down the line. The Pig Hollow Jungle Camp pulls into view. You roll off, and here's what you find. The ruins and ashes lie scattered around. The jungle is empty and bare. The shanties and tents all burned to the ground. Not a fire or a friend anywhere. Now, a rich man, he lives in a house made of stone, high on a hill looking down. A poor man, he lives in a tar paper shack way out on the backside of town. But a rich man don't worry about his fine house. Oh, it's protected like you never saw. While a poor man gets railroaded out by the cops and his house gets burned down by the law. A poor man is fighting for all that he has. He stands with his back to the wall. A rich man, he spends nearly half of his life just chasing a little white ball. But the rich man, he says that Pig Hollow must go. It's a place where the crooks rendezvous. But don't you suppose if you burn down a bank, you might flush out a scoundrel or two? Your bulldozer's rolling through my part of town. The iron ball swings, they knock it all down. They knock down my flophouse, they knock down my bars, and they blacktop it over to park all your cars. So where do I go and where do I stay? When they knock down Skid Row and haul it away, I'll flag a fast rattler, ride it on down. Boys, they're running the bums out of town. You run out the hookers that work on the street. Then you build a big hall where the playboys can meet. My bookie shop closed when your cops pulled a raid, but you built a new hall for the stock market trade. Where will I go? Where will I go? And where will I stay when they knock down the Skid Row? When they knock down the Skid Row and haul it away, I'll flag a fast rap. Flag a fast rattler and ride it on down, boys. They're running the bums out of town. Now I've come to find there's just one kind of war. That's the one going on between the rich and the poor. I don't know a lot about what they call class, but the upper and the middle can all kiss my s***. And where will I go? Where will I stay? When they knock down the Skid Row and haul it away, I'll flag
drag the fast rattler and ride it on down. Boys, they're running the bums out of town.
The IWW Hall was one of the few places that a hobo could find companionship, a place to rest, and a meal. The Wobbly headquarters usually included a kitchen where a large pot of mulligan stew simmered on the stove and an enamel coffee pot was kept full. Radical literature was available for all to read. Often there was a piano put to use by a Wobbly who picked out popular tunes and led some singing.
Oh, why don't you work like other men do?
How the hell can I work when there's no work to do?
Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
Oh, why don't you save all the money you earn?
If I didn't eat, I'd have money to burn. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
Oh, I like the boss. He's a good friend of mine. That is why I am starving out on the bread line.
Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
Whenever I get all the money I earn, the boss will be broke and to work he must turn.
Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
Joseph Etter. The workers are more powerful with their hands in their pocket than all the property of the capitalists. As long as the workers keep their hands in their pockets, the capitalists cannot put their hands in there. If the workers of the world want to win, all they have to do is recognize their own solidarity. They have nothing to do but fold their arms, and the world will stop. All the world that's owned by idle drone is ours and ours alone. We have laid the wide foundation, built it skyward stone by stone. It is ours not to slave in, but to master and to own, while the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
Solidarity forever.
Solidarity
forever. For the union makes us strong.
The tactics of direct action found expression during the next few years in various forms of pressure applied by IWW members through strikes, free speech fights, boycotts, and demonstrations.
Across the country, from Tacoma, Washington to Skowhegan, Maine, the message of one big union stimulated strikes among loggers, miners, smelter men, window washers, paper makers, silk workers, and streetcar workers. Wobblies staged the first sit-down strike in America at the Schenectady, New York plant of the General Electric Company in December 1906. In the frontier town of Goldfield, Nevada, an IWW strike won a minimum of $4.50 a day for most of the cooks, waiters, and bartenders. In Portland, Oregon, the IWW helped win a 9-hour day and a wage increase for sawmill workers. Lawrence, Massachusetts was a mill town. Of 86,000 people living in its borders, 32,000 worked for the mills. 27 different ethnic groups, speaking 22 different languages. They came to find a haven, but the 10-hour, $2 day, 25 cents a day for children, made Lawrence their purgatory.
January 11th, 1912 began as just another payday at the Everett Mills in Lawrence. It would not remain so for long. The state had recently enacted a law shortening the work week from 56 to 54 hours, with no cut in pay. But workers worried that manufacturers would compensate by illegally trimming their meager wages. These fears were soon confirmed. Moments after the first workers anxiously opened their envelopes, the cry, "Short pay!" rang out. Then, as word of the cut spread, a group of Polish women shut off their machines and walked out.
The next morning, the strike spread to other mills. The women went from room to room, smashing light bulbs, cutting belts, shredding cloth, and pulling non-strikers from their machines. "Better to starve fighting than to starve working," they shouted. Within 4 days, 10,000 men, women, and children were on strike. Within another week, 22,000 had left their jobs. One striker carried a sign that read, "We want bread, and we want roses, too." The words became an emblem for the strike. As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched by all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, "Bread and roses, bread and roses." As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men. For they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching, we bring the greater days. The rising of the women is the rising of the race. No more the drudge and idler, tend that toil where one reposes. But a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses, bread and roses. The poverty and the danger of a prolonged strike fell hardest on the children of the strikers.
Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. We took some of the children away from Lawrence to other cities once or twice. And then they tried to stop us, and they beat up the children and the mothers and the committee in the railroad station in Lawrence and took them to jail. And a protest and roar went up from one end of the country to the other. They tore down that railroad station later. I'm sure one reason is that they didn't want people to be pointing at it as the place where the police and the soldiers had beaten the women and children.
6 weeks into the strike, on February 24th, Flynn tried to put another 40 children on a train for Philadelphia. The police, with clubs drawn, attacked the group, arresting 15 parents and children, and they sent 10 terrified children to the Lawrence Poor Farm. The newspapers headlined the situation, and the publicity forced Congress to investigate the conditions in the shops. The strike was won by mid-March, with wage increases from 5% to 25%. The largest increases went to the lowest paid worker.
Intermittent strikes, strikes on the job, and sabotage were means of gaining practical concessions quickly, as well as part of the long-term battle to weaken the capitalist system. In 1915, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn wrote, "Sabotage means either to slacken up and interfere with the quantity, or to botch in your skill and interfere with the quality of capitalist production so as to give poor service. Sabotage is not physical violence. Sabotage is an internal industrial process. It is simply another form of coercion.
Sabotage symbols of a wooden shoe and a black cat appeared constantly in wobbly illustrations and cartoons. Stickers and circulars showed a black cat displaying its claws. The words "sab cat," "kitten," "fix the job," were used to suggest or threaten striking on the job, sabotage, and direct action. The boss has cream for his lordly dinner. Feed him milk and make him thinner. Hurry now, wonder how. Meow, sabotage. If you are down and the boss is gloating, trust in me instead of voting. Hurry now, wonder how. Meow, sabotage. Oh, the rats all hate and fear me. Meow, meow. The softest paw can be a claw. They seldom venture near me. Hoorah, they saw your sabotage kitten. Hoorah, they saw your sabotage kitten. Oh, the fight is tough and you can't see through it. Shut your traps and a cat will do it. Hurry now, wonder how. Meow, sabotage. The tiger wild in his jungle sittin' never fights like this here kitten. Hurry now, wonder how. Meow, sabotage. Oh, the rats all hate and fear me. Meow, meow. The softest paw can be a claw. They seldom venture near me. Hoorah, they saw your sabotage kitten. Hoorah, they saw your sabotage kitten.
In order to squelch wobbly organizing, a number of Western cities declared street speaking against the law. Missoula, Montana, 1907. Spokane, Washington, 1909. Fresno, California, 1910. San Diego, California, 1912. Everett, Washington, 1916. The IWW conducted about 30 major free speech fights of up to 6 months' duration, all of them centered on the IWW's right to recruit members at street meetings.
Utah Phillips. Now, one of the songs for the Spokane free speech fight was composed by Joe Hill and was introduced to the streets by Haywire Mac McClintock, a well-known singer, very active in the IWW in those parts. Haywire would hide in a doorway with T-Bone Slim. A mass of workers would be gathered around the Salvation Army donut dollies. A man would walk by carrying an umbrella and a briefcase and dressed in a tight suit with a string tie and a bowler hat. He looked just like a banker, but functioned like a carnival shill. He'd yell, I've been robbed. Help, I've been robbed. Everyone would rush over to him. What's the matter? What's the matter? They'd ask. When enough had crowded around, he'd shout, I've been robbed by the capitalist system. And then the boys would jump out from the doorway and start singing Joe Hill's song. Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what is right. When you ask how about something to eat, they will answer in voices so sweet. You will eat by and by in that glorious land beyond the sky. Work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. Oh, the Starvation Army, they play. And they sing, and they clap, and they pray, till they get all your coin on the drum. Then they tell you that you're on the bum, and you will eat,
you will eat,
by and by,
by and by,
in that glorious land beyond the sky.
Way up high.
Work and pray.
Work and pray.
Live on hay.
Live on hay.
You'll get pie in the sky when you die.
That's a lie.
If you fight hard for children and wife,
try to get something good in this life. You're a bad man and sinner, they tell. When you die, you will sure go to hell. But you will eat.
You will eat.
By and by.
By and by.
In that glorious land beyond the sky.
Way up high.
Work and pray.
Work and pray.
Live on hay.
Live on hay.
And you'll get pie in the sky when you die.
That's a lie.
Working folks of all countries unite. Side by side, we for freedom will fight. When the world and its wealth we have gained, to the grafters we'll sing this refrain. You will eat by and by, when you learn how to cook and how to fry. Chop some wood, 'twill do you good. And you will eat in the sweet by and by, and that's no lie.
Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. Their techniques were something like the Freedom Riders of today. They would send telegrams. Now I'm explaining, you understand, I'm not agitating. They would send out telegrams something like this. Footloose wobblies, come at once. Defend the Bill of Rights. And they would come on top of the trains and beneath the trains and on the sides and the boxcars and every way that you didn't have to pay fare. By the hundreds, literally, they would land in these communities to the horror and consternation of the authorities. And they would stand up on platforms or soapboxes and they would read part of the Constitution of the United States or the Bill of Rights. Until the cops came and took them away.
Jack Miller, there were so many of us there in the jail that there wasn't room to lie down. We had to make a system where men would lie partially on top of one another in order to get some rest. The diet we had was bread and coffee once a day. Well, that lasted 3 days. And then we decided to retaliate by building a battleship. This was IWW jargon for doing unpleasant things for the benefit of the jailer. Since there were no tin cups or bars to bang, about 20 of us went into the center of the room, locked our arms, and jumped as high as we could. The aggregate weight, which was about a ton and a half, came down in one spot. Buildings are not made to sustain such abuse, and it wasn't long until almost everyone was in the circle. People who were observing from outside have since told me that the building began to sway. Finally, Mayor Gill came and promised better food and some blankets. The meals did get a lot better, but the blankets were a mixed blessing as they were infested.
The Industrial Worker, April 14th, 1917. I love my flag. I do. Which floats upon the breeze. I also love my arms and legs and neck and nose and knees. One little shell might spoil them all or give them such a twist they would be of no use to me. I guess I won't enlist. I love my country, yes I do. I hope her folks do well. Without her arms and legs and things, I think we'd look like hell. Young men with faces half shot off are unfit to be kissed. I've read in books. It spoils their looks. I guess I won't enlist.
Preceding and during World War I, the IWW took an anti-militarist stand, opposed the entrance of the United States into the war, and continued to lead strikes in contrast to the no-strike pledge of the AFL. Since the 1905 founding of the IWW, the organization had opposed war not only on the basis of anti-militarism, but on the grounds of anti-nationalism and anti-capitalism as well.
Ralph Chaplin, stand by the flag, the lie that still allures. Lay down your lives for land you do not own, and spill each other's guts upon the field, your glory gift of mangled flesh and bone. But whether in the fray to fall or kill, you must not pause to question why nor where. You see the tiny crosses on that hill? It took all those to make one millionaire.
Employers vented their fury on dissenters who, they claimed, were threatening national security and the capitalist system. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, the Daily World editorialized, "The first step in the whipping of Germany is to strangle the IWWs. Kill them, just as you would kill any other kind of snake. It's no time to waste money on trials and continuances and things like that. All that is necessary is the evidence and a firing squad."
Army troops and community vigilante groups raided IWW halls and members' homes across the country, dispersed outdoor gatherings, disrupted meetings, and jailed members.
The Industrial Worker printed a notice in one of their issues. "To our patrons, notice. Parties desiring to raid any of the various offices of the IWW, please book your dates in advance, as this form of amusement is very popular."
Across the country in 1917, 184 IWW members were arrested by federal agents and charged with interfering with the war effort, encouraging resistance to the draft, conspiring to cause insubordination and disloyalty in the armed forces, and injuring citizens who sell munitions to the government. Approximately 100 IWW defendants, including Big Bill Haywood, were convicted and received severe sentences, 20 years imprisonment in the case of the better-known leaders.
The post-war years were marked by further criminal prosecutions of the IWW in many states. In addition, community hostility toward every form of radicalism led to continued harassment of the organization.
Wobbly prisoners kept active and alert through their jail terms. They maintained their organizational identity within the prison, elected committees, planned education programs, and circulated books and literature. They asserted their rights within the jails as they had done on their jobs. Direct action techniques were used to obtain better jail conditions.
Despite the corporation-inspired U.S. government terrorism against it, the IWW continued to grow, and to grow mightily, throughout the next 5 years. The union reached its all-time peak membership in 1924.
And today, does anyone really believe that we can find effective solutions to the pressing problems of our time? Racism, sexism, homophobia, homelessness, globalization, and environmental destruction, with anything less than the freest and most revolutionary imagination and creativity?
Joe Hill and the old-time Wobblies are still very popular among young radicals and have a profound influence on many contemporary social movements. The Wobblies' dream of a better world and the means they imagine and improvise to realize that dream have never ceased to touch the hearts and minds of those who value freedom above all and who are now daring to dream revolutionary dreams of their own.
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of armies magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old. For the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Dump the Bosses Off Your Back, 100 Years of the Industrial Workers of the World in Songs and Stories with Charlie King and Karen Brandow. DC 37 Radio is broadcast Sundays at 8 p.m. and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. over WNYE 91.5 FM. And for more DC 37 news, views, and updates, visit the DC 37 website at www.dc37.net. That's www.dc37.net, where you can also listen to archived DC 37 radio programs. And for DC 37 Radio, this is Ken Nash in Solidarity.